conversation before that. So be Chanukah then. Good. Now, we are on Daf Nun Aleph, Amud Bet 51b. We read through the Mishnah, and then we spent the major piece of the latter part of our class last time discussing the nature of money. What is money? How does money function? What is good money and what is bad money? And the conclusion that we drew was that money on the one hand is arbitrary. Money is a convention. Money is something that any group decides will work as a way of creating some means of simplifying transactions. That if we lived in a barter society, it would be simply too difficult to carry on a lot of business. Therefore, money is a good substitute. So money, in a way, and much of the time, is simply a convention that works. However, the problem with a convention is that the convention doesn't seem to have any clear value to it. It's simply convention, and people decide on what its value is. And that, of course, is the reality with which we are living, where we're not sure because of the conventions and because there are certain things that hopefully will make other things have some conventional value, which seem to work a lot of the time, but not all of the time. And when they don't work, it's really bad. It's really bad, and we know that very well. So that, on the one hand, is the conventional side of money. On the other hand, money also is something that tries to achieve some sort of recognizable value, even where money is a convention. As we were saying last time, the Chinese money is undervalued, and that is a cause of problem in international trade. Two weeks ago when we were doing this, Mr. Obama had either was still there or had just come back, I don't remember. And one of the issues on his agenda was the low valuation of the Chinese currency. So even where money has a conventional value, still it tries to achieve some level of reasonable value as well. Now, of course, in the classical world, you have a slightly different reality, which is where things, metals, have a certain value. And coins, therefore, not only have symbolic value, but they have real value, or at least as real value as they have, since there is a market for certain metals. Classical metals were silver and gold. And to some extent, they have a clear value. Nothing is ever clear because it depends on the supply and demand. If you suddenly flood the supply with a lot more silver or a lot more gold, the price goes down. And that is that way today, and that always was that way. Nonetheless, at some point in time, in antiquity, we know from the presence of coins in archaeology that coins became a means by which commerce was conducted. But the classic use of coins was that the coin itself had a metallic value. Right? It's only very, very recently that we're using coins without metallic value. And when I grew up, a quarter was a quarter. It had a certain amount of silver, and by law it had to have a certain amount of silver. When we would have happy occasions, we would always get silver dollars. And they were real silver dollars. Or as real as silver dollars ever were, I guess. Some alloy of silver, but there's an awful lot of silver in it. I don't know whether Susie and B. Anthony dollars have much silver at all in them, or whether that's an issue anymore, because things have become much more conventional. But so money does have a value, or it did have a value anyway, until very recently. It may yet come back, because these things have a way of persisting. when things turn into a lot of chaos, people want to go back to hard values. They want to be sure that a dollar is worth a dollar. So the problem, well, money, coins that have value, of course, wait, step back one. If we have metals that have value, in theory we could just weigh out the metals. So we don't need coins. That's one way to do it. That's possible, but it's cumbersome. Okay, it's cumbersome. Because every time you have to do something, you have to have a scale. And not everybody has a scale. Some people, of course, in the ancient world did have scales. Merchants had scales. And then merchants and coins also had scales. Namely, money changers. That's one of the things that money changers dealt in was weights. They would weigh the money. They would weigh the money. Now, part of the reason for weighing the money is, in fact, to see whether the money weighs enough for a dollar still to be a dollar. Because if, to some extent at least, the value of this thing, or the name of it, as a dollar, depends upon a certain weight of silver in it, then it's the nature of silver to wear off. And it could be that at another point, that it has less and less and less silver, and what point does it no longer become a dollar? Or a shekel? Or a pundion? Or a dinar? Whatever it is. Okay? It's a basic, basic problem. So, on the one hand, we want money to be fungible. We want to be able to use it very simply. On the other hand, we want money to have a clear value. Now, to some extent, by giving coins names, we're really doing two things at once. On the one hand, we're giving the money symbolic value. We're saying a certain amount of weight in silver is called a dollar. Okay? And the problem that we're going to have with that is it always a dollar? Because it looks like a dollar? Or does it have to weigh a dollar? At what point does it not become a dollar? Okay, because if we started this whole thing assuming that a dollar's got to weigh a certain amount, it could just weigh too little. That's just the reality of these things. That's how it happens. So on the one hand, it has an objective reality, but also has a symbolic reality, because we may decide that dollar is good within certain parameters, let's say. But after a certain point, it's no good anymore. Now, the way the Talmud puts that is in terms of ona'ah. That's the subject that we are discussing, ona'ah. Ona'ah, which generally means over or undercharging. But the concept is used for money as well, and I don't know that it makes sense to translate it as over or undercharging, although there is a sense to that. Okay? It's when the money, basically is not worth what it's supposed to be worth. And the one who's likely to be injured here is the seller, right? Because somebody buys a suit and pays the seller, gets the suit. So the buyer has the suit. What does the seller have? Seller only has money. The worst thing is if the seller has money, which suddenly isn't worth anything. I read a story recently about somebody, who is it? Was it in North Korea? Oh, yeah, maybe that's what it was. It was North Korea, right? It was something where you had...
They just exchanged paper currency for a new paper currency. They limited the amount people could exchange, and the old currency that they had hoarded for any day becomes worthless.
And it becomes worthless.
They cut off the last two zeros.
Right. So that's fine for all the stuff you're going to make tomorrow. But everything that's in your trunk, you're in deep trouble. You know, there are ways you could turn in the money, you know, there may be, but frequently they don't do that. They don't do it. It's just...
There's a limit on how much people could turn in. This was to eliminate
speculation. Okay. So, this is the issue we're dealing with. Now let's turn to the Mishnah, 51b2. Kama tehei osel chasera velo yehei ba'ona'a. How much can a seller be missing And it won't be a case of ona'a. Here it translates it as fraud. Well, fraud has a lot of overtones to it, which I don't think is really relevant here. It may not really be an issue. Nobody's trying to put over anything, something on someone else. But the seller wants to be sure that when he gets paid, his money is worth something. Okay. Lo yehe ba'ona.
What is seller?
What?
What's the word seller?
It's not here. I'm adding that word.
Here is the word seller.
Oh, what is a seller? Oh, a seller is a coin. A seller is a coin. And you have here in note 20 the relative value of coins. This is a useful note, but I think it's not worth dwelling on too much because it can really get you mixed up. A seller is 2 shekels, a shekel is 2 dinars, a dinar is 6 ma'ot, a ma'ah, which is 6 ma'ot is the plural, 1 is a ma'ah, is 2 pundions, and a pundion is 2 isars. Just try to remember that. Okay? Let's see how you do it. Okay, so whatever it is, the seller is a certain amount of money. It's a standard coinage. But think of the shekel as a dollar. This is probably a $10 bill, something like that. Or a $5 bill. Kama tehe asela chasera velo yehe ba'ana'a. Rabbi Meir omer, 4 isarot. 4 isars. It can be missing 4 isars of weight. The amount of weight that would be in 4 isars. Isar le dinar, which is an isar per dinar. The only thing that's important is what the English note has here right on the page in parentheses, which is to say 1/24. That's the key thing. So Rabbi Meir is saying that even if 1/24 of the real value of the coin has disappeared, at that point it's no longer a valid transaction. Okay, so that's not very much at all, because what had we learned was the value of ona'a in normal transactions, 1/6. So 1/24 is much less than 1/6. Rabbi Yehuda Omer, Rabbi Yehuda says, 4 pundiot, pundion le dinar. 4 pundions per sella, which is a pundion per dinar. Bottom line is 1/12. 1/12. So this is not as stringent as the first point of view, as Rabbi Meir's point of view, but it's still twice as stringent as we're normally used to. Rabbi Shimon Omer, Rabbi Shimon says, 8 pundionot, 8 pundions per sella, 2 pundionim le dinar, or 2 pundions per dinar. That is to say 1/6. All right, so we're finally back to what we're used to. The last point of view, let's be sure whose this is. This is Rabbi Shimon. Rabbi Shimon's point of view is what we're used to, the 1/6. But the others are 1/12, and the first one was 1/24. Okay? Now, remember the characters here. The first one was Rabbi Meir, was 1/24. The second is Rabbi Yehuda, is 1/12. And the third is Rabbi Shimon, which is 1/6. So there are 3 different possibilities here. Okay, goes on. Ad matai mutan lachsir. What is the time limit for returning a defective coin? And, you know, assuming that it has gone beyond the threshold that we know is a threshold of ona'a, what's the time limit? Because we saw that in goods, there was a time limit. And now we want to know as far as money goes. Interestingly enough, it's very different. It's bakrachim ad kedei shiyare leshulchani. In large cities, until time elapses for him to show it to a money changer. Okay, so the assumption is that bankers, they were the bankers in a relatively simple society, bankers see a lot of money. I remember growing up, and I still sort of see it today, but it's actually, it looks a lot different because of the development of technology. But I remember till probably, 4 years ago, the Citibank on 86th Street had a window that opened to the street. And what was it called? It was a night deposit. It was a night deposit. Nearly every bank had that. It would have a night deposit. And I understood always that merchants didn't want to hold on to their money. They wanted to deposit it for safety. So a merchant would finish whenever he finished his day, and if the bank was closed, whatever the arrangement was, and I always wondered what it was, I would see people going in, they had a key, and they would open up the night deposit, and they put in the money. And close it with a key, and that was it. So there is a relationship between merchants and banks for a variety of reasons. Here, I think it was probably safety. Although, what do I know? Maybe it wasn't safety. Maybe a merchant wanted to be sure that he earned interest on his money. And in the morning, he's already got to open his store. And he would much rather have his money in the bank, both to earn interest or to pay his bills. And I don't have time for that. So it's a complex relation now between the merchants and the banker. Well, here, that was the Shulchani. The Shulchani was a banker. In essence, the banker. And the notion of the bank, as far as I know, was not, at this stage of the game anyway, to guard money, as we would think from theft. That was not the function. Yes, to guard money, in that the banker knew the real value of money. Either by looking at it, because he dealt with money all the time. He could look and tell the value of a coin simply because that's his business. Or he also came equipped with all the scales. So that it was apparently something that was common for merchants to go to the Shulchani, to the banker. So here, Bakrachim, in large cities, Ad Kadesh Yer LaShulchani. Obviously, merchants would go to show their coins to the money changers, because only the money changers knew whether the coins were worth what they got for them, or worth what, they sold an object, and maybe the coins they got were really not good coins. So the money changer would know that. Bakfarim ad arvei shabbatot. In villages, assuming there are no money changers in the villages, until the beginning of Shabbat, the next Shabbat. There, I assume, what functioned instead of the Shulchani, if it's instead of the Shulchani, what it means is that simply this is the time that people do commerce. Erev Shabbat, people do commerce. So people come together, and whoever is in the know is there at that time. I'm not sure it means that there is no Shulchani, because it could be that the Shulchani appears just once a week. You know, that he has a temporary job as opposed to a steady job, which you would have in a city. Commerce is just much less in a small town. But commerce takes place on the Friday, and it could be that the Shulchani would make his appearance only at that time. And it would then be for the same reason. Okay. So the merchant could make reference to the Shulchani. The Shulchani would then be able to tell him which coins were not worth the value that they were supposed to be worth. And then the merchant would have the opportunity to return those coins and say, I want my goods back unless you can give me better coins.
Are we assuming in the smaller towns there would not be a money changer or a banker, and that other merchants may just be able to know
that's one value, possibility.
But it's not really scientific.
Not scientific. In a small town, a lot of things are not scientific. But that's what it is to live in a small town. People enjoy that. It has its own way of commerce. People are more personal, less scientific. But what are you going to do? That's the way it goes. Okay. So even there, though, there are opportunities for people, in fact, to make these judgments in a reasonable way. And those are done on Friday, simply because that's when commerce is done. Okay, we go on. Imaya makira. If someone who passed the defective coin recognized it, Now, that's an interesting possibility, because that's not something we think of, although every once in a while, I'm sure it happens to you as it happens to me, I get a dollar that somebody's written something on. And you know, somebody's going to write a story about, you know, what's behind that. And I always kind of wondered. These days, I see people take pens and they go over some merchants. If you give them a high value, let's say you give them a $100 bill, they won't just take the $100 bill. They take a magic marker of some kind. And I don't know what goes. Do any of you know what happens? Why people do that? Does that happen to you too?
They want to see the magnetic ink.
What is it?
Magnetic ink.
You mean you think that's a special magic marker?
Yeah. Or they can look against the light to see the waterworks.
Or maybe it has to show a certain color.
Yeah,
maybe that's what it is.
Special.
I noticed that people do this.
It has to show a color.
Yeah.
So there are. It could be that there were coins that you would recognize. That coin could have a defect in it. Any of you collect coins? Coin collectors know these things. For a very short while, years ago, I had friends who were coin collectors, and they were crazy about things. I remember every time we get a coin, they would look at it and say, oh, this was minted in Denver, and this one from Chicago, and I don't know. Yeah, then they sensitize you to these things that people like me are not sensitive to. But apparently in those days, at least, I don't know whether it's still true, there were all these letters on the coins. And those were the letters of the mint. And you knew where the coins came from. So there are a variety of defining characteristics which could be associated with a coin. Therefore, if the coin is recognizable as a unique coin, then the time limit doesn't make as much sense. The real problem with it, the reason you need a time limit, is that all money looks alike, more or less. So that you can't let this come on forever, because a guy could, you know, he could do a transaction days later and get the same value of a coin. That coin could be the bad coin, and then he's going to take it back to the original purchaser and say, I'm sorry, this coin is no good. They'll say, no, that was 2 days ago. You know, this is somebody else gave you this coin. I didn't give you this coin. That somebody else gave it to you. So you need limits for that, because otherwise it's just chaos. But if you're in a unique position, the ein lo alav ele taromet. Oh, afilu the achar shnei masal chodesh mekablai menu. It's possible to, if it's so unique, it is possible to carry on this transaction to give it back 12 months later. The ein lo alav ele taromet, that he has nothing against him but a valid cause for a complaint. So I'm not clear exactly what that means. Taromet means, taromet is not the same as ona'a. Ona'a can cancel a transaction, depending upon the details. But taromet is not that. Because taromet means that you have a valid reason to complain about somebody, but you have no recourse in law.
And make you unhappy.
Right. You can make somebody unhappy. You can make them feel guilty. But you can't really do it. You can't do anything about it. Okay. The notna lemaaser sheni vein chosh eno choshesh. One may use it. It being here, a coin that has eroded. One can use it for. Maaser sheni, remember, is the farmer has produced a certain amount of produce in the Galilee. According to the Torah, he is required to take a second tithe in a seven-year cycle, in 3 years of the seven-year cycle, and to bring that tithe to Jerusalem. Since if he lives very far from Jerusalem, it's a cumbersome thing to do. What he can do is that he can turn it into money. He has to pay a certain penalty, but he can turn it into money. And then he comes to Jerusalem and he buys food and celebrates in Jerusalem. So, notnola maaser sheni, eino choshesh. One may use it for deconsecrating maaser sheni and not worry. In other words, we don't worry. We're not so concerned about the problems of ona'a, even with a coin that may have eroded too much, we let it go by for some of these divine obligations. She'eino ela nefesh ra'a, for it is only one of ungenerous disposition who refuses to take such a coin. In other words, this is what you see operating here in the Mishnah. On the one hand, we want it to be precise. On the one hand, we recognize the fact that money has to be worth what it's supposed to be worth. On the other hand, this is not a good system. There's a value to that. We understand the value to it. But if you press it too much, number one, it's not good for commerce. Number two, it's not nice between people. Because people will keep reacting to each other. You know, if you can imagine, every time you get a coin, if you have to weigh it, or you have to check it, it leads to trouble in human relations. So to be a stickler about these things is considered bad form. That's the way I would translate nefesh ra'ah. Nefesh ra'ah literally means a wicked soul. In our language, it's bad form. In other words, it's not a way to be nice. It's not a nice thing to do to be a stickler about these things. On the other hand, there may be situations where, you know, where it makes sense. But to just do it too much is not nice. So on the one hand, we see the value of having a certain clear value for the money. On the other hand, money as a convention is so important for society that we don't want to push the issue of value too much. Somehow we've got to find a balance between the two. Any questions still here?
Yes. Maybe a little concrete, but the issue of knowing that the person knew at the time that he passed the coin that short weight, that seems like...
Not relevant.
Oh, okay.
Not relevant. Because it doesn't... In all your questions of intention is not relevant.
Right, but that is what struck me, though, mm-hmm. at least the English translation.
Is the word recognize? Yeah, that was right.
Where is that?
It says, if the one who passed the defective coin recognized it, it seems conditional on the person passing it.
No, on the way back.
No, this is on the way back.
Within 12 months, it will show you that you recognize.
Right, this is not that you recognize what you're doing wrong, but simply that you recognize that this is the same coin you gave. That's all. Okay? It's kind of an odd circumstance. It's not something that we're familiar with.
Are we talking here exclusively about kind of uniform erosion of the coin as opposed to, say, filing off?
Well, that's an interesting issue. We don't know. We honestly don't know. I think the general assumption is we're talking about erosion. Having said that, there's no reason to limit it to erosion, because it could be advantageous to file off coins. The reason it would be advantageous is that if you had enough coins, you could collect the silver. You could just take off a minimal amount of silver, and this is done. That's one of the things that classically was done with coins, is to shake a bag. You shake a bag, and the coins rub against each other. A certain amount of silver, over time, will simply fall into the bottom of the bag. So that is one way of swindling. So that's a possibility, but that's not the only possibility.
What year is this conversation taking place?
The Mishnah is before the year 200 CE.
So, but they're not talking about Roman coins.
They are talking about Roman coins. I assume that, there were different coins at different times, because some of the coins of that period are Roman coins. Some of the coins in the early Mishnaic period were local mints of the Jewish monarchy. You have, because we have all these things, we have a lot of work that's been done on this today, archaeological work. You've got both coins were in circulation roughly the time of the end of the Second Temple period, let's say. By the Mishnaic period, there is no more minting of Jewish coins. It's all Roman coins. Although I'm not entirely sure what Roman coins mean. I don't know whether Roman coins were minted in Rome or they were minted, let's say, locally in the Roman Empire. That I just don't know the answer
so
to.
So the Romans might have used the units here, the cella.
Yes, these are Roman units. These are international units. They're all those. I don't think the shekel is an international unit, but I believe that these other, the pundion, I believe, is a general unit. That's not a Hebrew word. These are well, and remember that the language of the Roman Empire was Greek and not Latin. So that we're reading the Eastern Roman Empire, which was a Greek Roman Empire. At least as far as the commerce and coinage was in Greek terms.
Pudion is listed here by him as derived from a Latin word.
I can't believe
Roman
it.
Coin.
It's possible. What do I know? I am not an expert in it. Okay, we go on to the Gemara. Now, the Gemara, this is one of the nice things about Gemara in Bava Metzia, is that it's classic Gemara. You and I are talking the language of money, trying to understand some of the concepts here. The first thing the Gemara is going to do is to be much more sensitive than probably we have been to the simple language of the Mishnah. Look at what the Gemara says. The English translation is good here. Mishnah is writing, how much can a cella be missing and there be no fraud in it, in using it, indicates that coins have eroded exactly in the amounts listed by the Mishnah are still valid for use. So, in other words, the Mishnah that we read, go back to the Mishnah, Kama tahe a cella chasira, how much can it be missing? And it won't be missing too much, so that we call it ona'a. So in other words, this 1/24th, if something is missing 1/24th, it's still usable. What we are saying, in effect, here is anything more than a 1/24th is not usable. Anything more than a 1/12th is not usable. Anything more than a 1/6th is not usable. That's the Mishnah's language. So the Gemara says, Ureminhi, but don't you remember a Baraita which puts it differently? Baraita says something different. Ad kama tahea sela chasera, how much can a coin, a sela, be missing? Diye ba ona'a, and it will be ona'a. Now, the language is slightly different, but it's very different. Because here we are saying, when it is missing 1/24th, it's ona'a. The Mishnah said, when it is missing 1/24th, it's not ona'a. It's more than a 1/24th. Okay? So that's the difference. The Baraita was slightly different in the way that it is the way it's structured, but practically there's a very important difference between the two of them. Right, ad kama tahea sela chasera yeheva ona'a. And already at this point of a 1/24th, a 1/12th, or a 1/6th, it will be ona'a and therefore not usable anymore. Amar of Papa. Papa answers, lo kasha. This is not a contradiction. That's what frequently happens. When we have the Mishnah and we have a Baraita, we think there's a contradiction between the two. Rabbi can sometimes say, lo kasha, not a contradiction. How? Tanya dida, Tana didan, our Tana, namely the Mishnah. Tana, remember, is a teacher in the period of the Mishnah. Kachashi mimata lamala. Our Tana is starting from coins with only little erosion and considering coins with increasing levels of erosion. So in other words, he's going in one direction. V'tana bara, and the Tana of the Barai, takachashi minamala lamate. He's going the opposite direction. It's simply a matter of the where they're starting. They're not really saying that there's any difference. They're just putting it differently, which is probably what we thought to begin with. But indeed, it doesn't have to be that way, but that's the conclusion the Mishnah comes to, the Gemara comes to, that it's simply they're just talking slightly differently, but they mean the same thing. Because we don't know what they mean, but that's what Rav Papa says. Maishna. And it leaves it. It seems to be satisfied with that. The problem here was simply a problem of having a baraita, which had a slightly different form. So they're satisfied with that solution to the baraita problem. Now, the Gemara goes on and raises a different problem. Maishna besela deflige. Umayishna betalihi talafligi. First of all, the language. Maishna. What is the difference? We have two different fact patterns here. One was what we originally learned about Ona'a. We originally learned about Ona'a that it was one sixth. Okay? That's what the Mishnah said. And then do you remember there's Rabbi Tarfon? What did Rabbi Tarfon say? One third. Very good. Okay. But the first opinion of the Mishnah was just the Mishnah's opinion. Look at the Mishnah on 49. Where did we start out? 49b. Okay. Look at 49b2. Mishnah says ha'ona'a. Ona'a is defined as arba kesef me esrim ba arba kesef l'sala. 4 out of 24, namely 1/6. Okay? Shtut l'mekach. 1/6 of the transaction. And then Rabbi Tarfon says, no, 1/3. So who says 1/6? Whose name is that in? Who's? Well, nobody's. Yehuda Nasi is the editor. That's correct. But as far as the Mishnah is concerned, at least for that Mishnah, it is brought stam, anonymously. Anonymously. The assumption being, therefore, that all of the rabbis were in agreement with one exception, with the exception of Rabbi Tarfon. Because if that were not the case, we would have seen a variety of disagreements there. Okay? Since we only see one disagreement, the basic assumption is that nobody else disagreed except Rabbi Tarfon. We could have had, or may yet get, some Mishnah which tells us, no, Rabbi Tarfon was one of many, and that could be possible. But at least from just the text itself, Rabbi Tarfon is the only one who disagrees. That is the force of what we are reading. Maishna besela defligu. Why is it when we get to the subject of money, in this Mishnah that we are just reading now, defligu, we find that Rabbi Yehuda has one position, Rabbi Shimon has a position, and who is the other one?
Meir.
Okay, the first one was Rabbi Meir, the second one was Rabbi Yehuda, the third one was Rabbi Shimon. We see there are three different positions, and none of them appears in the first Mishnah. So in the first Mishnah, when we were talking about buying and selling goods, they have no disagreement. However, when it comes to money, they have a disagreement. Now, let's just see the language here. The language is nice in this Gemara. Maishna besela deflige. Why is it the case? Why is it different that they have a disagreement as far as a sela goes? Now, the Mishnah always speaks in the very concrete terms. It won't talk abstractly about money, but we'll talk specifically about a sela, namely a certain coin, a $5 bill. Okay? Umayishna betalit alaflige. Now, the word I wanted you to see here was talit. Now, you know what a talit is. What is a talit?
A garment.
Now, we assume that a talit means a talus, a talit, a ritual object called a talit. A talit doesn't mean that at all. That has come to be common religious parlance for what in the Talmud is used as the word talit in the Talmud means simply a garment. It's a garment. because it became a specialized garment, it then was referred to as the talit. But talit in the Talmud does not mean a talit. Talit simply means a garment. Now, a garment is not money. A garment is simply an example of a normal transaction of objects, of movable objects. And therefore, the talit frequently in Baba Metziah becomes the example of the movable object. Earlier on, for example, in Baba Metziah, the Mishnah, the classic Mishnah is Shnayim Ochazim B'talit. Two people grab onto a garment. This one says it's mine. This one says it's mine. Where do we go with it? Okay? Shnayim Ochazim B'talit means two people grab onto a garment. It doesn't mean they grab onto a talit. It means they grab onto a garment. So here, the garment now is symbolic of movable property. So what's the difference between the two? Why in the issue of money do these three rabbis argue, and in the issue of movable property they don't argue? Amar Rava, Rava says, Man Tana Talit. Who is the Tana of the Mishnah regarding a Talit? Rabbi Shimon, hui. You said it was Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi. He sees that, of course, in this Mishnah, who says 1/6? It's Rabbi Shimon. So maybe what we are seeing in the Mishnah originally is the point of view of Rabbi Shimon. Because we see that even as far as coins go, he says 1/6. So it must be Rabbi Shimon's point of view that we saw in the first Mishnah. Okay? Amar, Abaya, Amar. Abaya has a different answer. Because that's not such a good answer. What's the problem with... What?
They would have said his name.
You're correct. You're absolutely right. Why didn't they say Rabbi Shimon? And the assumption that you made first, that was the correct assumption. Why? If it would be no rabbi's name would be mentioned, why would we think Rabbi Shimon? We would think Rabbi Yehuda Nasi. That would be the more logical thought. It's exactly what you thought. So it's an argument, but it's not a great argument. Okay? So, where you have an argument, not a great argument, where Rava says one, you can be sure the next opinion will Abaya. Rava and Abaya always argue with each other. Okay? Abaya Amar. Abaya says, no, that's not the, it's not a question of who said it. There's a real difference here. There's a real difference between these two types of things that we're dealing with. Talit ad shtutz machil inish. When you are dealing with a piece of clothing, ad shtutz machil inish. With as far as a piece of clothing is concerned, people are willing to be rather liberal in their views about clothing because, you know, some people think a piece of clothes is worth more, some people like it a little bit less, some people want it more, some people want it less. So there's a certain amount of more play in the transaction when you're dealing with a movable object, something like a piece of clothing. Talit ad shtut mechil inish. A person is willing to forgive up to a sixth. There's a wider latitude as far as clothing goes. The Amre Inche, as for example, people say, there apparently was an expression here, Ashik Lagabaych, overpay for your back, the Shave Likresaych, but get your money's worth as far as your stomach is concerned. Now, what that means, it's only the first part is relevant to us, overpay for your back, that means you can overpay for clothes, but don't overpay for food. Right? Food, you know, food, there should be more standard pricing for food than there should be for clothing. Because food is food. And people, you know, bread should be the same price. Or more or less the same price. Clothes, you know, people get carried away with their clothing. And therefore, you know, we understand that. So if you're going to get carried away with the clothing, don't get carried away with the food. Food, you should be ready to pay a standard price for.
A few weeks ago, we talked about perishable goods, wine, and the drunk, or the food, so could that be a factor?
That could be a factor. That's a good point, right. That could very well be a good
point.
Yeah. Yeah.
I was going to suggest maybe differently. To me, it harkens a little bit, you can overpay for a luxury, but not for a necessity.
Yeah, that's exact. I think that's precisely it. That's very good. That's a good way to put it. I think that's precisely what's here. Exactly. Yes.
In this chapter and in the earlier chapter, they always talk about, on the half, about the value of the merchandise or the money. But what about, on the half, about the quantity? I can tell you there are 10 eggs that I sell you, but I will only give you 1/6 less. Is this on R, or this is within the boundary of okay business?
I don't understand.
Until now, we talk on every, like, garment or the value you receive.
I mean, sometimes you buy in quantity.
Quantity.
In quantity, yes.
Am I allowed to sell less than 1/6 and still get the full amount of money?
No, I think it would be the same thing. As long as it's movable property, the same standards would apply. Because, of course, the value would be different. If you sell in quantity, you sell at a different price.
But you cannot count if you buy 10,000 something.
Whatever it is. The price for 10,000 would, I would assume, in all cases be less than the price for one. I mean, the price per item would end up being less.
No, but they don't even indicate that they are talking here on the value.
Yes, that's correct.
And they don't talk about
quantity buying. I don't think, however, that the principle would be different. Because what would apply in movable property applies simply across the board.
I'm just saying, can you change the quantity that you actually sell the person? He's saying if you try to buy 1,000 sheep, and you only give the guy 950 sheep, and because that's within a sixth of 1,000, can you get away with
that? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah.
Oh, that's forbidden. but that's called stealing.
So you stand up 2 days and count the sheep.
Yeah, that's called stealing. Because
if this is called stealing, then the whole deal is not correct.
No. Because if you're representing that you are buying or selling X number of things, and in fact you come through and you pay and you don't give the quantity, then that's not a case of ona'a.
That's fraud.
That's what we would call fraud. Because there you're lying. You're lying. Here, this is not a case of lying. Could be a case of lying, but also could not be a case of lying. It could be just that, you didn't know. It's a matter of lack of knowledge, not of intent to lie. And that's different.
But didn't you have a case where the merchant deliberately gave,
and the rabbis didn't like it. You can't do that. I mean, he was playing with the law in order to get away with things, and that was a bad news.
Wasn't the whole concept of not intent to defraud, but not selling at the market value, that if it's a sixth of what it's a value, that would be a problem.
The notion of ona'a,
defrauding somebody, obviously would not be.
The notion of ona'a involves no intent whatsoever. Intent is irrelevant to ona'a. It may be intent, it may not be intent, but it is irrelevant. Now, if you are engaging in direct fraud, that's not ona'a. That's called stealing, and that's just a different. It's similar to ona'a. I'm not saying these are, there's no relation between the two, but it's essentially different.
But you can have the example of the sheep without any intent.
Yeah,
I think my flock is 1,000. Mm-hmm. You're buying the flock. I think it's 1,000. You end up with 950.
Mm-hmm.
So, I think though that the answer is the same. And then that would be ona'a, wouldn't it?
The terms are simply I think you're pushing it in a direction the Talmud is not going in. I'm not saying that these things are okay. They just fall differently in the law. The law discusses them differently.
So when you can quantify a transaction, then unless you verify it, it will be on R only if it's unquantifiable, and if it's quantified, I have a time to count it and then to...
I suppose. I'm not. Again, the Talmud is not addressing that,
but
I suppose that that would be true, yes. Okay?
I think in real life we have these situations all the time. If you went into the store and you bought a pound of coffee, it's marked clearly 1 pound. You took it home and it weighs 11 ounces. This is fraud. If somebody says, I'm going to sell you a sack, I don't know, it looks like a 100-pound sack to me, I charge $1, it's $100. But... you want to weigh it, otherwise, and this happens in real life.
Sure, sure.
Could be an aspect here that's similar to like no-fault insurance. It's creating an objective standard that almost protects the structure of society where people aren't going around closing. You know, if it's more than that, it's one thing. We're not going to necessarily go into whether you meant to defraud me or you didn't mean to defraud me. You're more than one sex, you've got to rescind the transaction.
Mm-hmm.
It does, you know, in a small community, it's probably not all that bad of a thing not to have to...
I think you're exactly right. I think that's exactly correct. Let's not get waylaid with this. Let's get back to the Mishnah. We were focusing on the fact that now this is Abaya is trying to figure out the difference between the first Mishnah that we dealt with, where it's 1/6, and now we see three rabbis arguing 24th, a 12th, and a 6th. Okay? Why the difference between a talit, an object, and a sela, and money? That's what we're trying to define here. Rava made a stab at it, Abaya is making another stab, and Abaya is simply saying that there is a qualitative difference between transactions that involve objects, and that is that people are willing to forgive more in terms of objects, and the end of that is sela, as far as a sela is concerned, money is concerned, kevan de lo sagile, since it does not circulate. Well, that's not a good translation. I'll give you another one in a minute. Lo machil. A person does not forgo a deterioration of even less than a 6th. Even the lo sagile, if you take a look over at the Rashi, this is about the middle of the page, just opposite. Little below the middle. Kevan de lo sagile, she'eno yotze bahotza'ah. A coin at a certain point isn't used in currency. So people don't want to use coins. They don't want to accept coins. Coins don't have a, how did we say it before with the garments? The garments have judgmental value. They have a lot of sentimental value, or they have personal value, and therefore we're willing to forgive more with garments. We want, however, our money to be as objectively valuable as is absolutely possible and enable us to carry on a system of money. So in fact, what Abaya is saying is correct. I think Abaya's got the right idea here. Abaya is saying that simply these are different because the nature of these things is different. The nature of objects is different from money. And people want their money to have a stable value, or else money has no value. If money simply moves up and down all the time and moves within a tremendous amount of latitude, it's not useful to us as money. So money really needs as objective a value as you can possibly achieve. We can't say that it's an absolutely objective value because there's no way to do that. Coins will constantly lose their objective value. So because that's the nature of having a coin. It will lose a little bit of its silver. Okay?
We learned earlier that there's a distinction made between transactions between a merchant and a buyer and a private sale.
Correct.
Where in the case of a private sale, there are emotional factors that enter into it, which make the object's value different from market value of a commodity. So here, what Avaya is saying is that actually every transaction involving an object, material, is not rigidly defined by a market.
At least not as clearly as his money.
Yes.
Yeah.
So is that contradictory or reasonable?
I think it further refines it. Further refines it, I think.
I think that the distinction is the difference between a real commodity and a mechanism of exchange.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this idea of the saying you should accept something that may be not exactly there is a way of maintaining the value of the money as a mechanism of exchange.
That's correct.
Independent of its commodity value. And I think that the system instinctively appreciates these two very different functions.
Right. And that's why you have different points of view as far as money goes and fewer points of view as far as the rest of the objects go. Because in order to, once we're talking about money, on the one hand, we want it to maintain its value. We don't want it to be able to diminish in value. On the other hand, that may not be workable.
But we don't really care about the commodity value as long as it retains its transactional value.
They may be related, though.
We have done very well with paper money with no intrinsic value.
Maybe.
As long as the system works.
You may have done
very well. But the system has worked for a long time.
I wouldn't say a long time. It's worked for a while.
Well,
I think
40 years into it.
40 years is not a long time.
Okay.
We talk, 100 years is a short time.
Okay.
We have to talk in terms of 500 years. So I think we're still testing this. It seems to be working pretty well.
But the value of the money is its transactional value.
You have confidence that other people will accept it, and
that then.
But what Henry is saying is crucial. What you're saying is crucial. You're right as long as he's right. Right? But it doesn't always work that way, because sometimes people lose confidence in their money.
When we went off the treasury note, which were exchangeable for metal. Gold was $42 an ounce. Today it's almost $1,200 an ounce. So, October 1973, the official break. So, you can't say that the paper currency has held its value, and you can't say that people have a great deal of confidence in it, because times of stress, they run away.
That's fascinating, because you're looking at it from the other perspective, in terms of its relation to something like gold, which has an objective value.
Which fluctuates enormously. Gold's been up and down over those 30 years.
Well, has gold been up and down, or have dollars been up and down?
Well, in dollars, it's been up and down.
It depends on the perspective you're looking at.
Again, I'm just back to, as long as the function of money is to make transactions,
as long as it retains
that ability, the absolute connection to some notion of intrinsic value is much less important. This is the way I would phrase it, and that's what makes it very different than the garment.
I think that is true. Okay, we keep going. Gufa. Now, the Gemara brings more of the Baraita. We just encountered this Baraita at the very beginning of the Mishnah. Now we see it. It's a lengthier exposition of it. Ad kamat tehe asela chasera v'yehe ba ona'a. How much can a sela be missing for there to be fraud in using it? Rabbi Meir Omer, Arba'a isarot, four isaras per sela, isar lidinar, which is say, isar per dinar. Rabbi Yehuda omer, arba pundiot, pundion lidinar. Rabbi Shimon omer, shmona pundiot, shne pundion lidinar. Eight pundions, which is two pundions per dinar. Yater al kain, if it was more than this, mochra bishovya, he sells it for its worth. Now look at note 17. The Gemara below 52b explains this to mean that if the seller has not worn down to this degree, that is, it is worth more than the level of ona'ah, it may be used at face value. Okay, so what we are saying is, it takes a certain threshold to kick in the problem. And until that threshold is met, even though the coin isn't worth as much, we consider it as if it's worth as much. Because what we want to be able to do here is to establish a certain amount of stability in the currency. We can't do that absolutely, but we can do it relatively. And that's what we're trying to do. So yeter al kein mochra b'shovya, if it has lost more than that amount of ona'ah, at that point, till some point, you can sell it for only its value. Before you've reached that threshold, it has, in fact, more value than its real value. Once you get beyond that threshold, you can only use it for its value. Okay? Now, the right to now discussing a coin can erode to the point that it is worth less than what people assume it to be worth, though they realize that it is eroded. They may not be returned for fear that it may be used to cheat someone. At a certain point, we can develop additional problems. Here the Gemara will discuss that. Ad kama tipached v'hera shar l'kayma. Up to what point may a coin be reduced? You're losing a certain amount of metal from the coin. And it still be permitted to keep it. Or is there a certain point at which it becomes unusable? Now, there can be a variety of reasons why it would become unusable. First of all, it could just be unidentifiable. Or it becomes such a problem because it weighs so much less than it's supposed to weigh, and it doesn't look like that. Because remember, when a coin loses value, it doesn't lose value generally in its circumference. It loses value in its thickness. The most obvious way that you can tell a quarter from a nickel is not by its thickness, but by its circumference. And that's generally true with coins. Coins are defined by their circumference. So you have a potential problem here where, since you can't see these differences very much, yet at a certain point the coin has lost a lot of its value, it could become problematic to keep that coin in circulation because it just doesn't look like what it is. Okay? So here, ad kama tipachet v'hera shar l'kayma. How much may a coin lose of its actual metal, and you still be permitted to keep it? B'sela ad shekel, with a sela until it is worn down to a shekel. That is to say, half its size.
Half its weight,
correct. Now, we're not saying that it can be used as a sela. At that point, we're saying it can be used as a shekel. It could be used at whatever it weighs. Because there's a possibility of not using it for the coinage that it was made, but it still has its own independent value. At a certain point, the problems associated with that are just too great, and we want to just remove it from circulation. So here, a shekel is half a sella. Look at note 18. If a sella is worn down to less than a shekel, it cannot be retained. It may not even be used at its actual value. This was forbidden to prevent people from illegally trying to use it as a shekel. A sella coin that had eroded to less than a shekel's weight would be wider but thinner than a shekel coin. Right? At that point, let's say it gets to be even less than a shekel. It's much wider than a shekel. It's much thinner than a shekel. People might want to use it as a shekel. But you get all mixed up. You don't know what you're doing when you're using the coins. The erosion of coins affects their thickness. Their diameter remains basically the same. Its large diameter might mislead people into thinking that it contains at least a shekel's weight of silver, since people mistakenly think that an eroded coin cannot have lost more than half its original value. That's what Rashi says. That's how Rashi explains it.
Seems tautological. Yeah. Since everybody knows you get rid of it once it's a shekel, then people think it's...
Well, but you only know that if we tell them that.
Right, so I'm just saying this is self-fulfilling once you make the rule.
Yeah, well, but until you make the rule, you realize the problems that people are having here.
Right.
There's a practical problem in the use of the money. So you make that rule, and of course, once you've made the rule, then it's self-fulfilling. There's no doubt about that.
But you could make the rule at any level.
Yeah,
but
that's certainly true.
Same issue.
But to some extent, it responds to the reality, though.
Yeah.
You know, it's just a real, this is a track record of reality of how people react when coins get to be certain sizes.
Where coins get to be certain sizes and the commodity value is of any significance.
Correct.
In the United States, nobody cares whether you give it a worn nickel or a pristine nickel.
I've had people, I've seen people react.
Oh, a worn coin?
Correct.
They're not sure that they're going to accept it?
Because it's a holdover from the old days. It generally, there are parts of the country where people still react very much the way money looks. I found that that is true. It doesn't happen here, but there are parts of the country where people do things a lot differently than we do them. And I remember, you know, seeing that.
Maybe in Maine, they're concerned about the Canadian currency.
Well, no, that's a different issue. That is, and one of the interesting things I find with Canadian currency, in Maine itself, in a place like Acadia National Park, Canadian currency is used at the value of American country currency. Coins. Not dollars, but coins. Dollars have to be exchanged. But coins are used as if they're American coins. Because there's simply so many of them in circulation that it becomes problematic to return them. And you can't, if it's an example of what we were talking about, you can't really carry on decent commerce that way. You put too many people on the spot and you discourage people from using their money. And merchants don't want that to happen, even though in theory the merchant might be the loser. But in the very narrow context here, the merchant isn't the loser because there's a convention that we just accept that. Whereas the convention, though, as I said, excludes the dollars. Paper money is excluded from that, whereas coins are not excluded.
The law of the having a losing all value of the seller, if it's below half of its value, it's pretty draconian. If you're getting totally wiped out, if it loses that value. Now, you could, I suppose, at some point, exchange the seller the dinar.
Exactly.
And if you were to do that, you wouldn't have the problem of being wiped out.
That's correct. That's correct. You could do that, and in theory,
you could find someone to take it.
To do it.
Right. Well, you have to get someone to take it, or in theory, if you had a means to melt it down or to give it to the authority that was making the coins, it's worth whatever it is. It has a value, and so it hasn't lost all its value. It may have lost a fair amount of value, but not all of its value, if you can get it back into circulation.
Well,
or you can drill four holes and sell it as a puppet. Wait,
the Gemara is going to get there. You know where the Gemara is going. The Gemara is going in that direction.
No, the same year.
Maybe, if I understand it, it has to get, or it gets to a point where it's of no value. If it's in such, no, it doesn't represent an amount of money, in which case then it's just an object and it could be sold then at market value to someone who has it.
Correct.
Down.
That's correct. That's correct. That's a fair. That's a good way to think about it. Let's go on a little bit further, because you'll see the Gemara is going to come to sort of this conclusion. Ad kama tipached v'ehen rashay l'kayma besela ad shekel, with a sela until it's worn down to a shekel, b'dinar ad rova, a dinar until a quarter. Pachot mikain isar asur. If it is an isar less than this, it is forbidden. Hare ze lo yim karenu. One may not sell it, the coin that is eroded to the point at which it may not be retained, even for its present value, at a certain point. Lo letagar, v'lo lecharam, v'lo leharag. Neither to a merchant, to an extortioner, nor to a murderer. Mipnei shemiramim ba et acherim, because they are liable to deceive others with it. Namely, there are all kinds of unscrupulous people who are looking for these things and who will force otherwise innocent people into compromising positions. So because the amount of potential abuse is so great, and you feed into the hands of people who like to make use of that abuse, in fact, you have to take it out of circulation. And the Gemara then says, Ela yikavena, rather he should make a hole in it, v'yitlena betzavar bino, o betzavar bito, and hang it off the neck of his son or his daughter. In other words, it should become an object, as you were saying, as opposed to money. Okay, at that point, it's an object. It's interesting, by the way, that apparently men wore necklaces of some kinds. So there is male decoration here as well as female decoration. Assume that it's a matter of decoration.
But Jewish people are not supposed to have, after the Sinai event, to have any beautification on their ears.
Who said?
That's why we Orthodox don't go with any earrings or diamonds or anything.
You don't think so? I don't know who you know.
You've been in conflict.
We know different people. We know different people. No, there. It is true that in the Orthodox community there tends to be an abhorrence to jewelry on men. When I officiate at weddings, frequently people who are more traditionally minded, men, will frequently not want to wear a wedding band. Wedding band is not widely worn in the Orthodox community. Having said that, it's plenty worn. And it's also something that is done. So it depends. It depends on the people. And diamonds, they're all over the place. Diamonds are all over.
So I kind of shocked about this murderer. I mean, does this mean that if you had only, worn down coins, and the murderer would accept that, and you would get to live?
No, it means that the murderer will force people to use these things, or he'll kill them. He'll kill them. Well, some people are unscrupulous in what they are willing to do in order to accomplish their goals. That's what I think is being referred to here. The murderer, it's not good to have things that murderers like to use, because they have no scruples about using them, and they'll kill people.
I think it's not interesting good that they equate a merchant with an extortioner and a murderer.
Well, there are...
an opinion about them.
I don't think they're necessarily equated as being the same, but simply we take the coins out because each of these categories of people can abuse the privilege, as it were, and it's just better to get rid of these things than to keep them in circulation. Yes.
It's interesting they're still using the 12, like the Babylonian or Assyrian numbers, rather than the decimal.
You're quite right. Yes, the numbers that we are using. That's correct. We're using a numerical system which is based on 12.
The British used to do it until a few years.
Well, even I've heard the Americans. We still have in our measurements. We have a system of 12. We're still using, which makes everybody else in the world think we're crazy. But it persists. These systems persist. And you're right that this is a system of 12.
We have Dominion, then we have Abraham. He goes by...
He's by a decimal. He's in the decimal
system. He's a decimal.
That's correct. Correct. So it's, none of these things operates absolutely and exclusively. Okay? Keep going. Amamar. The sella ad shekel bedinar arova. With a sella until it... This is just repeating what had been said above. The sella until a shekel, with a dinar until a quarter. Maishna besella ad shekel. Why is it that a sella is valid only until it has been worn down to the size of a shekel, half its original size? Maishna bedinar ad rova, whereas a dinar is valid until it's a quarter of its original size. We would have thought we have a principle here, one half. And it doesn't matter what the coinage is, it's a half is a half. So why would one be a half and the other be a quarter? Amar Abaya, Abaya says, my rova tekanani name. What is the meaning of a quarter that the Baraita states? It is in fact half a dinar because it is called a quarter relative to a shekel. And it means rero v'shekel. I know that's just like our situation of a dollar. A quarter is not a quarter of a 50-cent piece, it's a quarter of a dollar. So it's the same thing here with what they're talking about. These are, it's half of something, but it's a quarter of something else. Okay? So, in fact, the standard here of half is what functions. And the Gemara then goes on, Amarava daikanami. In fact, he's agreeing. Usually he disagrees with Abaya, but in this case, he's saying Abaya is absolutely right. And you can see this from the care used in the language itself. Tekatani Rava, because it is written, the Tana says Rova, Vela Katani Revia, and it doesn't say a quarter. In other words, it's using something the way we do it. It's calling it a quarter, but not a quarter of. So it's using it as a general term, meaning a quarter. La malay limitle bedinar b'shekel. Why does the Baraita refer to a fraction of a dinar in terms of a proportion of a shekel? Milta agav urke kamashmalan. Is simply teaching us something incidentally. The ika dinar da ati mishekel. That there is a dinar that derives from a shekel. A shekel coin is equal to 2 dinars. And so sometimes, simply the way things are formulated, it's formulated in such a way that you learn more than one thing at once. Not unusual. Any questions?
Let's take 1/6.
What about the 1/6 argument? We haven't decided between 1/24, 1/12, and 1/6 yet. Oh, but that's different. That's a different consideration we're dealing with. Right? Very good. To be continued. Mochti.